We're talking with Nick Redfern about his new book, Close Encounters of the Fatal Kind. Before the break, got into the strange death of Captain Thomas Mantell, who died while chasing a UFO. Some say it was a balloon, some say it was a planet. People who served with Mantell, though, say that's ridiculous and an insult to him as a pilot to say that he wouldn't be able to tell what it was that he was chasing. When we come back, strange information in Nick's new book about Mantell's body that I had never read before. And we'll ask him about other military crashes, whether it was some sort of an undeclared war going on that we weren't told about. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. Some years ago, Nick, I had the pleasure of interviewing a guy named Howard Cannon, who served with Captain Thomas Mantell. He was there when the Mantell died. And he told me years later, before he, Howard Cannon, died, that it was an insult to he and other pilots that Mantell wouldn't be able to tell the difference. Howard Cannon went on to become a U.S. senator, served four terms. He was instrumental in building Nellis Air Force Base and Area 51, and it was very interested in the UFO topic as well. So I got a feeling that there's a lot of people who would have served with Mantell who felt the same way. You spoke to a whistleblower, a British Royal Air Force person, who told you sort of much the same thing on a broader scale about other incidents involving crashes, right?
Yeah, this was a woman named Rita Hill, and Rita was a sergeant with the British Royal Air Force in the 1940s. She worked at a place in the south of England called Boscombe Down. Boscombe Down still exists today, and it's where the British military tests a lot of its new and sort of radical and unusual aircraft. Certainly, you know, it's not as remote as Area 51 or anything like that, but it is where, the British military test flies sort of new and exotic hardware. And she told me that as far back as the late 1940s, which is when she was stationed there, that when some of these new and experimental aircraft were being flown, the pilots would report suddenly being buzzed by UFOs. And they're often described as disc-shaped objects, or just sort of bright lights in the sky. But what's most disturbing of all is that Rita told me how on many occasions when these objects would appear, the instrument panels, the process of flying the aircraft just became impossible. The altimeters and so forth would just stop. The mechanics of the aircraft wouldn't respond properly. And there are actually a number of crashes. And she told me that there was actually one point in the late 1940s where they had, on average, a crash a week in relation to these UFO encounters, and that everybody was told, you know, you won't talk about this, and it went up the chain of command, and everybody was reminded they'd signed the British government's Official Secrets Act, which covered things like that back then. And the important thing was that, you know, Rita gave me a huge amount of information on her regular work, photographs of her time spent there. She clearly, you know, was who she claimed to be. And when I interviewed her, which was late 90s, she still remembered it very, very clearly and told me how it was such a, you know, not only was it disturbing, but it was a big tragedy as well, because they actually knew many of the pilots who were killed. You know, they were just young guys testing aircraft and suddenly found themselves plunged into a UFO situation.
The last time I had a chance to interview Tim Good, who is a colleague of ours, has written some really important books about UFOs. He had described sort of an unofficial, undeclared war that went on in the 1950s and maybe into the 60s, where there were a lot of planes all over the world that went down while chasing UFOs that were unacknowledged. I don't know, you don't touch on that in the bay in this book, but do you think that, did you find anything that would sort of support that view?
Well, yeah, I mean, there is, for example, there's a Mantell case. I talk about another one, or actually two mysterious aircraft crashes / disappearances in Wisconsin in 53, and there are other cases as well. And I think there's a good argument can be made that certainly in that era, we did lose a lot of aircraft. And I think the idea of sort of an undeclared war is an interesting one, because as far as I can tell, it seems that what happened was that, you know, the point came when there were so many disappearances of aircraft and crashes and so on, that somebody just gave the order, if you like, or even an unofficial order, you know, don't engage them any longer. It's right. Clearly not working.
Well, I know that happened in Russia. I know for sure it happened in Russia, because the guy who gave me the order told me that on camera. So I'm sure it probably happened here, too.
Yeah, I mean, it wouldn't surprise me, the idea that, I mean, after a while, you know, it's like the penny drops and we clearly don't have the upper hand or didn't have the upper hand then. And so I think it was more along the lines of just back off, monitor them, but don't try and engage them because you're just going to come off worse, you know.
One other point about the Mantell case, and then we'll move on, is that you made this note at the end of that chapter, and I had never read this before, about the condition of his body. Do you remember what you wrote?
Yeah, sure. This actually came from the deputy commander at Godman Field, which is where Mantell was based. He was actually part of Fort Knox. And the deputy commander at the time was a Captain James Deusler. And Deusler went on the record in the 1990s as talking not just about the case, but the condition of Mantell's body. And this was very, very strange. The fact that the aircraft that he was flying, you know, fell from the skies literally thousands of feet. And when they recovered his body, although his bones were reportedly shattered, as not surprisingly, there wasn't a single scratch on his body. There weren't any lacerations, no cuts, absolutely nothing at all. Now, you know, anyone who knows anything about aircraft crashes will tell you that it can be a grisly sight when something like an airliner goes down at high speed. But for Mantell, as I said, that he had no scratches, no blood, nothing. It was just sort of internally, you know, his body was massively disrupted, but externally, literally nothing at all, which was sort of very, very strange. And even Deusler noted years later that still kind of, you know, was puzzling.
Let's shift gears here to talking about whistleblowers and UFO researchers. Of course, you sometimes it turns out that the encounters or their interest in this topic turns out to be fatal as well. You don't have to be flying a plane and chasing a UFO to die. And the first one, and probably the most important one that you mentioned, is James Forrestal. Now, I've seen History Channel excerpts and different UFO shows that have taken this on and told a little bit of the history, but nothing with the kind of details and extra spin that you give this, including the Men in Black and then the CIA document. Let's talk about that for a couple of minutes, who Forrestal was, why he was so important to this topic.
Well, yeah, sure. Well, James Forrestal sort of had the distinction of being the first ever U.S. Secretary of Defense. And he was given that position by President Harry Truman in 1947, which was a very interesting year. You know, Roswell, Maury Island, the creation of the CIA, passing of the National Security Act, all in 1947. Now, Forrestal was sort of an interesting and very complex character. And he was someone who was sort of deeply skilled in terms of, you know, in terms of the job that requirements, you know, he was the perfect person for it. But he's also a very sort of emotional person as well, which isn't necessarily the best person to have, you know, holding that position where you've got to make major strategic decisions, sometimes hard ones, on a daily basis. Now, there are long-standing stories within the UFO field that after becoming Secretary of Defense, that Forrestal was briefed by somebody within government who was sort of running the UFO program, and Forrestal was essentially given all the information that existed on the UFO issue. And by all accounts, he didn't sort of take the information very well. It clearly played on his mind, disturbed him, to the point where over time, it almost sort of took him to the point of a complete psychological collapse, the sort of the dark and disturbing things he heard, and also the responsibility of having to sit on this information and not reveal it. Now, this all came to a head in early 1949, when Forrestal, as I said, pretty much did have an emotional collapse, and he was admitted to the Bethesda Naval Hospital in Maryland, and stayed there for a number of weeks, actually into towards the end of May 1949. Now, just before he went into the hospital, he became very paranoid that his telephone was being monitored, his mail was being intercepted, people were watching him and so forth. This actually coincided, 1952-51, when the Men in Black mystery really took off big time. And I mentioned this in the book because it's a very little-known aspect of the Forrestal story. But in the early 50s, the Men in Black would sort of typically look weird. They were often described as like 5 feet to 5 feet five tall, very strange features, very pale, anemic looking, and they would always travel in groups of three. Well, there's a weird Man in Black type story involving Forrestal that just before he was admitted to the hospital, he was speaking with a friend at his house when there was a knock at the door. And one of Forrestal's staff answered the door, and it turned out it was sort of a strange-looking guy who was looking to get Forrestal support for a program involving the local post office. And with hindsight, it seems like this was almost like a cover story to either destabilize Forrestal even further or to try and find a way into the house on the part of this creepy-looking character. Well, Forrestal and his friend were actually watching all this going on through the windows, and as the guy left, he met up with two other characters, in other words, a group of three, just like the Men in Black. And Forrestal came to think that this was sort of deliberately being done to try and intimidate him, and that may well have been the case. And it does have sort of very sort of creepy MIB overtones to it. But the most significant thing is what happened to him when he was taken to the hospital. As I said, he was taken there in 1949. And over the weeks he was in there, he actually made a very good recovery, to the point where the military man who was overseeing his room and just keeping an eye on him, Forrestal actually offered him a job as his personal chauffeur. And Forrestal was sort of looking after himself well, you know, shaving, showering, eating well, and clearly was coming out of this depressive state.
Now, in fact, he was hours away, right, from being released?
Yes, he was literally hours away. What happened was that his brother wanted to take him home to recover there. He thought he felt he'd have a better environment. But every time he found the hospital, he said that he would be given a different reason as to why Forrestal couldn't be released. And on the morning of May the 21st, 1949, Forrestal's brother phoned the hospital in a very angry state and essentially said, "I'm coming to the hospital tomorrow morning. I'm going to take my brother home, and you can like it or you can like it not, but that's what's going to happen." Now, the story is that Forrestal, on his release, was planning to essentially reveal to the world everything that he knew about the UFO phenomenon. Now, bearing in mind that his brother phoned the hospital on the 21st, was going to take him home on the morning of the 22nd, if somebody wanted rid of Forrestal, the only time they could do it would be the night of the 21st or in the early hours of the 22nd. And that's exactly what happened, is that Forrestal did die in the early hours of the 22nd of May. And what happened was that, well, it depends on whose version of events you accept. He either fell, jumped, or was pushed from the 13th floor of the Bethesda Hospital, and he came crashing down on a third floor canopy. And now, of course, you know, you're not going to survive a fall from 10 floors. You know, it's just impossible, unless you're really, really lucky. And Forrestal wasn't lucky. And the official story is that he tied the sort of the sash or the rope from his dressing gown around his neck and the other end around the radiator, and then clambered out the window and essentially let himself go. And the weight of his body reportedly tore the sash, and he fell to his death. The official story is he supposedly tried to hang himself. But there are a lot of questions. For example, the sash around his waist was just, you know, just big enough to go around his waist. But, you know, the official story is that it was long enough to allow it to tie around his neck and then around the radiator, and then actually to climb out of the window as well.
Yeah, that's a heck of a long cord. Jeez.
Yeah, and lower himself down. And we know he lowered himself down because there are actually scratch marks on the window, as if he'd been struggling to get back in. So it wasn't like, you know, he just fell straight out the window. He was clearly hanging, so that would be a substantial, you know, piece of cord. And so that in essence is the story. But one of the interesting things is that a few years ago, a document surfaced again through the Freedom of Information Act from the CIA, titled "The Study of Assassination," and it was actually like a guideline document for CIA personnel on how to make a murder look like an accident or a suicide. And it mentions that the most profitable way of doing this is to essentially throw someone from a high building, and where there's like a, you know, they're going to fall on concrete. It talks about how, yes, a bridge can be a useful place to do it, but if it's, you know, if it's got a river running below it, there's always a chance the person could survive. So it actually talks about, you know, throwing the person from a multi-story building onto a, you know, a sidewalk or the pavement. So
I'll read a chunk of it.
It's from early 52. So, you know, clearly that mode of death was mooted at that time, if you like.
Yeah, quoting from the document that's in your book, it says, and this is from the CIA, quote, for secret assassination, either simple or chaste, the contrived accident is the most effective technique. When successfully executed, it causes little excitement and is only casually investigated. I mean, that's really chilling, the fact that the government or a government agency would put something like that on paper.
Well, yeah, and again, it sounds controversial, but as I said, it's a legitimate freedom of information document. There's nothing sort of, you know, questionable about the documents at all. And it actually surfaced, not by accident, but the document itself was contained within like a larger collection of documents that dealt with the CIA's involvement in Guatemala in 1954. And this was like a huge file, and it turns out that this assassination document was contained in that file. So if people actually hadn't sort of petitioned for the Guatemala files to surface, the chances are we would never have seen this document that was contained in there as well. But the Forrestal story, for me at least, is a fascinating one and a chilling one, because, you know, if somebody was willing to take out the Secretary of Defense, then clearly they're not going to think of it twice about your average UFO researcher. So in other words, it's the implications of the death that are important as well.
Tell me this, Nick, do you think, and we're jumping out of order here, but do you think that there would be an organization that would still enforce that kind of an edict, that would need to? Or has the UFOs topic been so diluted by so much crap that they wouldn't need to do it anymore?
Well, yeah, no, that's actually a very good point. And I think this clearly only happens on, you know, limited occasions. It's not like UFO researchers dropping by the thousands, you know. I think it's just certain cases where somebody may get a little bit too close or knows too much. But what I actually believe in terms of these murders, I truthfully don't believe it is anything specifically to do with the US government. I don't think they're the parties involved at all. What I think is that there's some sort of like a shadow group, you know, one that isn't answerable to Congress, that isn't overseen by congressional oversight, that is sort of black budget funded. And that, you know, when the government says, look, we've looked for files on Roswell and we can't find anything, I'm one of these people who actually doesn't think they're lying. I think they're telling the truth. And I don't believe, you know, I don't believe the US government is going around killing UFO researchers at all. But I do think there's some sort of shadow group that may be like a multinational, very powerful organization to which the UFO program is almost like being privately siphoned off to.
I'm in agreement with that. If there is
those people who could be behind it,
if there's recovered technology or parts or pieces that they would have been transferred as well, have a buffer so nobody, people like you or I, couldn't get to them.
Yeah, and that's why. Yeah, I mean, I have people who said to me, "Oh, you know, this is all the government, evil government." I'm not just saying this. I don't think it is. I think it is like a multinational, powerful group. And probably a lot of these deaths, you know, somebody's just hired who's demonstrated in the past, you know, they're good with a gun or whatever. And it's not the agencies who we think it is. It's almost like a non-existent body, you know, that's dealing with the UFO phenomenon and all the offshoots from it as well.
I suppose if you could kill somebody like the Secretary of Defense, then it's not that much of a jump to say the president. A lot of speculation about whether JFK was ready to spill the beans about UFOs and whether that might have had something to do with his assassination. You have a chapter about that. It's some great information. We're going to jump into that right after this with my guest Nick Redfern, author of Close Encounters of the Fatal Kind. We're talking with Nick Redfern, whose new book, Close Encounters of the Fatal Kind, explores deaths associated with the UFO topic. And if you buy the idea that James Forrestal could be killed, then I guess it isn't too much of a stretch to wonder if the president could also be killed. A lot of speculation over the years that JFK was killed not because of Vietnam or other issues or because of a crazy lone gunman, but because he was about to spill some beans on UFOs, what he knew about UFOs. And I've always sort of been agnostic on that subject, a grain of salt kind of a thing, willing suspension of disbelief. Nick Redfern raises some pretty interesting questions about that and some new information, at least new to me. We'll jump into that and the mysterious deaths of a string of scientists as well. Coming up here on Coast to Coast AM. You know, Nick, I've always sort of been on the sidelines of the discussion about whether JFK might have been killed in relation to UFOs. It seems like a stretch to some degree, maybe wishful thinking on the parts of some UFO researchers. But I think you raise some pretty interesting points that give it at least the framework of credibility. Talk about that. What do you think about it? Do you think it is related or is at least worth discussing?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think when people think of the Kennedy assassination and UFOs and then actually combining them into two, even for a lot of people in ufology, you know, that's too much of a stretch. That's arguably the two biggest conspiracy theories in the world actually being part of one. But what is intriguing is that when we look into the Kennedy assassination, we actually do find a lot of UFO strands and themes. We mentioned at the start of the show the Maury Island case. Well, as I said, that when this strange wreckage was found at Maury Island, it was handed over to a man named Fred Crisman. Crisman was someone who had a very shadowy, weird background in the world of intelligence and actually popped up in the Kennedy assassination 2 decades later, to the extent that Jim Garrison, who was the district attorney of New Orleans at the time, played by Kevin Costner in the JFK movie, Garrison actually came to believe that Crisman was none other than one of the gunmen that shot Kennedy. On top of that, we have a guy named Guy Bannister. Guy Bannister was an FBI agent in the summer of 1947 who undertook a number of high-profile UFO investigations for the FBI at the time. And his documents have been, again, released officially. Bannister himself turns up in the Kennedy assassination. He was also portrayed in the JFK movie by Ed Asner. And both Crisman and Bannister knew each other. They both were associated with Lee Harvey Oswald. And so you have a connection between two men involved in the formative years of ufology, Bannister and Crisman, tied in with Lee Harvey Oswald. Now, one of the most fascinating things that I found, and again, this was sort of like with the Roswell thing, looking at not just the case itself, but what else was going on at the same time, was that one day before Kennedy was shot, he was killed on November 22nd, 1963. Well, on November 21st, Kennedy flew to Brooks Air Force Base in Texas, where he opened half a dozen new buildings that were dedicated to early research into what was termed space medicine. In other words, because this was the early years of the space race, so to speak, it wasn't really too well known as to what the long-term effects would be from exposure to low gravity and no gravity at all on the human body. You know, how would it affect bone structure and blood pressure and things like this? So that was one of the primary reasons for setting up this new project at Brooks Air Force Base. Now, it turns out that when Kennedy was at Brooks, bear in mind this is just 24 hours before his death, he had a behind-closed-doors meeting with a Major General Theodore Bedwell. And it turns out that Theodore Bedwell, in the summer of 1947, was actually the deputy surgeon at the Air Materiel Command at Wright Field, Ohio, Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. So, in other words, Bedwell worked in a medical capacity at Wright Field in the summer of 47 at the time when the alien bodies were reportedly brought in from Roswell. And his position would arguably have put him in a prime place to see those bodies. Now, it gets even more intriguing because in that very same visit to Brooks Air Force Base, Kennedy also had a meeting with a Colonel Harold Ellingson of the U.S. Air Force, who was actually the post-surgeon and hospital commander at Fort Detrick, Maryland, And there have been a lot of stories about alien bodies and alien viruses being studied at Fort Detrick. And certainly somebody like the post-surgeon and hospital commander at Fort Detrick might have been somebody who would have been brought into the program. The fact that Kennedy met both of these people just a day before he was killed, I find that intriguing as well. And the thing, the links don't stop there. Well, I guess one of the most controversial UFO books of the last few years, or the last 15 years or so, was Philip Corso's book, The Day After Roswell, Colonel Corso's book. A lot of people don't realize that Colonel Corso was actually a special investigator for Senator Richard Russell, who was on the Warren Commission. And Senator Russell, when in 1955 he went on a fact-finding mission to the Soviet Union, he actually had a very close UFO encounter. There's a document on his case now in the public domain, like a reporting file. And he was also briefed on the subject by the CIA afterwards. And that's just sort of like the tip of the threads that link the Kennedy assassination, you know, with various aspects of the UFO phenomenon.
Richard Russell was also portrayed in JFK, the movie, Walter Matthau, who was talking into the ear of the main character, the Jim Garrison character, and he told him about the Warren Commission, that dog don't hunt. So I think he was helpful to Jim Garrison, encouraged the investigation. What do you make of the stories about Marilyn Monroe, the Kennedy brothers having pillow talk and spilling the beans to Marilyn Monroe and Dorothy Kilgallen? Do you give that much credibility?
Well, again, I mean, when we look at the strands, it's interesting, even though it's a sensational story. Dorothy Kilgallen was a newspaper journalist and media personality. In 1955, she traveled to England on holiday with her husband and published a story shortly after her return to the US stating that she'd had a face-to-face meeting with a high-ranking British government official who told her that the British government had got its hands on a crashed UFO that was piloted by what she was told were, quote, small men. So she had an interest in the UFO phenomenon that definitely went back to 1955 and related to crashed UFOs. Now, there's an unofficial document in the public domain, which is reportedly a CIA summary of a wiretap conversation between Dorothy Kilgallen and a mutual friend of Kilgallen's and Marilyn Monroe's, a man named Howard Rothberg. And the story is that Kilgallen and Rothberg were discussing how Marilyn Monroe had told both of them that she was sort of sick and tired of the way she'd been treated by the Kennedys and that she was going to blow the whistle on all these various stories, so-called pillow talk secrets that Kennedy had told Marilyn Monroe. And this involved supposedly things like plans to invade Cuba and the then current relationship with the Soviet Union and so on. One of the stories supposedly related to after Kennedy was elected, that he was taken to a military base somewhere and showed the remains of a wrecked spacecraft and some unusual bodies. And the story was that because Marilyn Monroe was so fed up with the way she'd been treated, she was going to blow the whistle and do it quickly. Now, this particular document, which surfaced unofficially, I should stress, it didn't surface officially, came from a man named Milo Spriglio in the mid-90s, who wrote three books on Marilyn Monroe's death. And he talks about how she was going to go public, et cetera, et cetera. And the document's actually dated like 3 days before she was found dead, under circumstances which still provoke a lot of controversy to this day. And he talks about her diary of secrets and what she was going to reveal as to what was contained in this diary. Now, it is a fact that she was like a prestigious keeper and writer of journals. You know, she's often sort of portrayed as this ditzy, crazy blonde. But off screen, she was very interested in world affairs, politics, poetry, and lots more. And apparently in this diary of secrets, it contained all this data that she'd be told. A number of people did confirm they saw this, particularly at the coroner's office after her body was taken in for autopsy. And the people who've spoken out on this all said that within like 48 hours, the diary had mysteriously vanished or had been confiscated. So that part of the story, it's pretty safe in saying that, you know, the existence of the journal it can be vindicated. And Dorothy Kilgallen's interest in crashed UFOs can be vindicated as well, 7 years before she was speaking to Marilyn Monroe. Now, of course, the document itself hasn't been vindicated. It's still, you know, in that questionable grey area, so to speak. But in terms of when you add it to the rest of the story, you know, it does kind of add weight to it as well, I think.
You have a, we're never going to be able to cover all this, and we don't want to. We want people to check out your book, but you have so many different names of people who met weird ends, Morris Jessup and this guy out on the moors. But the one that really jumped out at me was Pat Price. I mentioned at the beginning of this program that the International Remote Viewing Association are meeting in Las Vegas this weekend, or out in Henderson, outside of Las Vegas. And you know, I know a lot of those guys. They've spoken so highly of Pat Price, who was one of the first and the best of the remote viewers. But the details that you have in this book, I had never heard before. So tell us who Pat Price was, the kinds of stuff that he did with his abilities, and then what happened to him.
Well, yeah, I mean, Pat Price was one of the most respected so-called remote viewers or psychic spies, if you like, in the 1970s. The 70s was the one era, I guess, more than any other, when remote viewing really came to the fore. The idea of using the power of the human mind, psychic phenomena, to spy on potential enemies like the Russians or the Chinese. And as I said, Pat Price was at the forefront of this. Interestingly, one of the things that Pat Price reportedly remote viewed were a number of underground installations where very human-like aliens existed. And he talked about Mount Zeal in Australia, another one in the Pyrenees Mountains, somewhere on the border of France and Spain.
One in Alaska?
Yeah, one also in Alaska. So in other words, reportedly all around the world. Now, the most controversial aspect of Pat Price's life, ironically, is possibly his death. This gets into sort of very weird areas. It actually occurred in Las Vegas. He checked into the Stardust Hotel, and several weird things happened. He mentioned to friends that just the previous evening, when he was in Washington, D.C., prior to flying out to Las Vegas, that somebody slipped something into his cup of coffee. Fortunately, he actually saw the person doing this, and so he didn't drink the coffee. Now, when he got to the hotel, he actually collided with another man in the lobby, and he didn't really give that much thought at that particular time. But in the early hours of later that night, he started to feel ill. And in the early hours of the morning, he got sicker and sicker, and it was actually on that day that he died. And it was actually put down to heart disease. Now, one of the things I point out is that the whole issue of this guy colliding with Price in the hotel lobby and then Price falling sick afterwards is actually eerily similar to something that happened in England, where I grew up, back in 1978, involving a man named Georgi Markov, who actually defected. excuse me, he was a defector from Bulgaria. And what happened was that he was actually stabbed in the back of the leg by someone with an umbrella, and it was actually put down to an accident at the time. But it was found on his autopsy when he died that Markov had actually been stabbed with a fatal poison. And this sounds very similar potentially to this situation with Pat Price, that it almost sounds like two attempts were made on his life, one with somebody slipping something into the coffee, which didn't work, and then possibly with this collision in the lobby that only hours later then he began to fall sick. And, you know, it's a very very strange story that sounds like somebody wanted to get rid of him.
When you hear him say, as a remote viewer, "I psychically see alien bases under a couple of mountains," it sounds pretty wacky. But we should point out, as you do in the book, that he had uncovered stuff that he wasn't supposed to know. I mean, he discovered they had tasked him to look for one thing, and he found something else, secret NSA facilities. And when NSA or CIA or both found out that he knew about them, they were very upset.
Yeah, they were. I mean, on the one hand, this, you know, demonstrates his skills. But I think on the other hand, you're quite right that no one really anticipated the sheer extent of his ability to sort of psychically penetrate not just overseas facilities, but classified internal facilities as well. And I think because he was perceived as arguably the leading remote viewer of the time, you know, it's not surprising that someone would have wanted to get rid of him. Now, one of the more controversial theories is that, you know, he was actually assassinated by extraterrestrials purely and simply because he'd uncovered this sort of network of underground installations, not just sort of in the US, but around the entire planet. And, you know, you could make a good argument, or you could ask the question, had he not been killed, how much further would he have gone with this remote viewing investigation of potential underground installations with a UFO connection? Maybe that had something to do with his death.
I would think the KGB would have wanted him dead. If they somehow found out about his abilities, they would have wanted him dead for sure. And I'm not sure, he might have been too much of a threat for CIA and NSA, figuring, gosh, a guy like that, who knows what beans he might spill.
Well, yeah, I mean, the KGB is actually a good candidate because I mentioned the death of Georgi Markov in 1978 in London. Well, that was supposedly done, as I said, by the Bulgarian secret police. However, they worked very closely with the Soviet KGB, and there have been stories that it could have been like a joint operation. So, this was just 3 years after Pat Price, 75 to 78. So, you know, I think the Soviets could be a good candidate as well.
We've got just a couple of minutes here. I wanted to touch on the guy, the MK Ultra guy, if you can tell that story in about 3 minutes.
Yeah, sure. Well, this is a guy named Frank Olson who fell to his death or was pushed very similar fashion to that of James Forrestal in 1959. And Frank Olson was someone who was heavily involved in the early 50s in the MK Ultra program of sort of mind manipulation and mind control, as it's become sort of popularly known. And the reason I mentioned this in the book is because over the years, there have been various allegations that some UFO events may have been sort of staged events to try and determine how far the mind could really be manipulated by seeing if people can sort of fall for faked UFO events. Now, the important thing I should stress is this doesn't mean there aren't real UFOs. There clearly are. But the idea is that, you know, sort of LSD and mind-altering drugs have been used to try and stage UFO events and see how far they can go. But Frank Olson was someone who was heavily involved with both the military and the intelligence community in terms of, new concepts and so forth in mind control. And the story is sort of highly controversial, mainly because of his death, which occurred in 1953, in November 1953, when he actually fell from the Manhattan Statler Hotel from the 10th floor and, like Forrestal, died. Now, there are actually a number of key events that link Olson with the UFO phenomenon. For example, one of the most intriguing ones is that some of the operations that he was involved in occurred at a place called Horn Island in Mississippi. This was actually only a couple of miles, and this was a mind-altering chemical weaponry was tested, one of them, a drug called BZ, which could have sort of bizarre and graphic hallucinogenic effects on people. The place where this was undertaken was literally only a couple of miles from where one of the most famous abduction events occurred in the early 70s, involving Charles Hickson and Calvin Parker at a place called Pascagoula, where they underwent a very strange abduction experience. But when we find that BZ was actually being tested just literally down the road from there, you know, that kind of makes me wonder if there was a tie-in with that particular case as well.
I'll tell you, Nick, we'll take a break. We'll continue our conversation about your new book, Close Encounters of the Fatal Kind, including this string of scientists that died mysteriously. And then we'll open up the phone lines with questions. I know there are a lot of them from our listeners.